showing that some of you don't like to stand up in a group and ask a question. I usually remember this after when it's too late. So do any of you have any questions? Interesting discussing the difference between, say, European and American reactions to things. Because in America we say, are there any questions? And everybody's going like this. In England, everybody sits there kind of thinking of something. I went to this conference in Dharamsala last March with the Western Buddhist Teachers Conference with the Dalai Lama. Ajahn Amaro and I and Sister Sundra went to it. And most of the teachers were Americans, and so just noticing that the Americans really talk a lot. And you know, I've been living here for 20 years, so I've become more in tune with this culture. So then I realized, you know, Americans just go on and they kind of, well, this is kind of rap. They go, yeah, yeah, that's it, that. And they interrupt each other. And the European Buddhists just sit there kind of thoughtful and looking a bit not quite intimidated by all this kind of speedy excitement from the Americans. So I pointed, they were complaining at this conference about, especially in the Tibetan, the ones in the Tibetan school, where the Western people in the Tibetan system felt somehow they weren't being supported by their tradition, and we were talking about the cultural gap between Tibet and the Western world. And then I pointed out the cultural gap between America and the European world. Which was very obvious there, you know, in the room you could see it. Yeah.
May I ask a question? I'm not a Buddhist, but I'm interested in the meditation side of things, because there's, besides Buddhists, there's quite a lot of European groups that are practicing meditation now. And the idea there, I thought, was making your mind a blank, empty, in the form of catharsis, cleanse the mind, and then it refills with good thoughts afterwards. But if one empties one's mind, isn't one at danger of whatever comes next?
Well, where you're understanding the mind, because like when if you're emptying the mind, you have to understand it. You can't just do it as an act of will, but understanding how the mind works, so that, like, we always have this, like in Buddhism, you know, to meditate, you have to determine to keep a moral standard, so that you do good and you refrain from doing evil. So that's a kind of basis for meditation. So that, because you will have, you know, bad thoughts, evil thoughts can come up, or as well as good ones. But then there's this wisdom that knows that evil thoughts, like things that cause harm to yourself or others, is something you don't do. But you're also aware of it as condition that comes and goes. So you're looking at it in terms of its quality of change, But in its characteristic of change, but its quality of being evil, you don't act on it, but you see it in terms of impermanence and not self. And then good thoughts like being kind, generous, cooperative, and so forth. Those are what our active side, what we do, how we live our lives, so that we, in the society that we live in, we do good, we try to be honest and respect the environment and so forth. And this is our determination. So the thoughts or impulses that come into our minds, they're to do good or be kind, and then we try to put that into action. Right, I mean, that was just trying to convey an attitude of mind for, say, gratitude or metta practice. Like metta is just that. At first, I found it easy to maybe spread metta to people far away or people I don't know or all sentient beings, but. But the real problems came in, especially with people that you're living with, who you have emotional reactions to, that are difficult for you, and to yourself. You know, a lot of mental states you have that you don't like about yourself. I found, like certain thoughts and emotions that I have, I don't like, so I always resist it, and so then taking metta. Into the more accepting, not judging, but accepting, stops this resistance, this endless kind of suppressing feelings, and so that so then your own kind of negative thoughts are then being accepted, and you're stopping this, you're not resisting them anymore, and then when you accept them, then they drop away, you know. But I found that so much of my suffering in monastic life has been this resistance to things, and it's a very strong habit, just a reactive resistance to all kinds of things creates suffering in situations where that you needn't suffer, but you're creating it. Yes? Right, well, I agree. I don't... the future life, I'm not particularly concerned with that. Because this is the one that I'm experiencing, this life here. And so I see, and because... With Buddhism, with Buddha Dhamma, you're developing this awareness around your life. So you're actually reflecting and contemplating on your life, and then you begin to see that when you do things in a out of bad intention or dishonesty or that the result is makes you feel inadequate or guilty or whatever. So then you really try to live your life much more honestly and skillfully. And then the result of that is that you feel, more self-respect and happy in this life. And the thing is that the Buddha was bringing the mind into the present. Because into the timeless present, and because time is the perceptual ability we have to remember the past or plan for the future or think about the future, but actual experience is always present. You know, we're always in the present, and yet in the present we start thinking about the past, planning for the future. And so the mindfulness is learning to establish yourself, to learn to relax, to to trust in just being in the present, to be in that state of open awareness in the present, which you know is where we're relieved from suffering and where we're getting outside the illusions of time, where we're actually beginning to realize the deathless or the immortal truth in the present. And then you know, the future life, well, that doesn't make any sense anymore, because no longer are you just living now in order the future will be something, you know, in order to get some kind of result in the future. But your awareness in the present is liberating you from the delusions about time altogether, or about being somebody who gets born and dies in various forms. I've done a lot of meditation on time myself, because I majored in history in university, and I've always been interested in the past, in history, in ancient history, and then I find myself fascinated by possible predictions for the future, and you know, wanting to know what's going to happen in the next millennium, having a curiosity about the time conditions, and that more and more the effect of the meditation of developing mindfulness in the present, suddenly the past and the future, the significance of the past and the future, it diminishes in your. You find your contentment in the present, and liberation, enlightenment, freedom is always in the present, rather than, you know, where if people think I'm going to meditate now in order to get enlightened in the future, if that's the basic starting position, you know, they're in for disappointment. Until you get behind that basic illusion about I've got to do something now to get something in the future. Once you break out of that illusion, you know, then you begin to see things in terms of the way they really are, and in terms of the truth, or what we call Dhamma, the truth of the way it is. Well, thinking is such a right thought. Rukhi has asked about to comment on what right thought is, because we were very, you know, like the human being is a thinking being, and I think even the word man, it comes from, probably traces its origin back to mano, or to Sanskrit or Pali, which means a mind, or the thinking being. Man originally didn't mean male, but it means, like in the Pali word mano, isn't it? The mind, manusya, higher mind. So we are thinking beings. We thinking process can be a real curse to us if we become bound and obsessed with our own thoughts, and that's what so many of us found our suffering with, was we just were thinking endlessly, and a lot of the thoughts were just so stupid or unwholesome or unpleasant that you. And yet the more you tried to resist or control, and you became obsessed with your own thoughts, and even some of your bad thoughts you became very obsessed with, the more you tried, you resisted them. So honestly, then I remember going through a period where I just wanted to stop thinking. But even though I wanted to stop thinking, I couldn't do it. You know, it's just impossible to just will myself into not thinking. And And then more and more I became aware of like in meditation, you're noticing where thinking stops. You know, you're bringing attention to that the thought process is impermanent, and you're more and more aware of when there is a thought and when there isn't, or the spaces between thoughts, or the gaps. And there are various ways of techniques of that we have where you observe the space in the mind, or the mind where there's no thought. And then you can be aware of thought as something that arrives in thesis rather than just an endless kind of relentless ongoing thinking problem. Also, right thought, like developing, you know, when you understand how thought affects you, your emotional state, then you're more careful about what you think. I found that training, like being a Buddhist, then I try to train myself to think in a more Buddhist way, because it's much more skillful than just thinking in my habitual way or my culturally conditioned way. So like my culturally conditioned way is to think I am Ajahn Sumedho and I'm this person, and the whole I am, me and mine is a conditioned way of thinking, in which you interpret your experience in life always on this personal, in this highly personal way. And then right thinking, I found, comes more in terms of the way the Buddha taught, in terms of there is the suffering is impermanent. It's a skillful way of using our ability to think that can interpret experience in a way that isn't filled with a lot of emotional reactions, where you're much, much cooler, and it gives you much more perspective. Where when you're interpreting always from this is happening to me, I like this and I don't like that, then you get highly emotive, and you usually get carried away by your emotional habits. But the real way is through this mindfulness, where the emotional habits and the thinking are seen in terms of conditioning of the mind, the rising and ceasing, and that which is aware, that awareness is the way, is the refuge that we use to contemplate that. And more and more you just feel this trust in this refuge in awareness, rather than trying to find anything as an object that you can trust. Because the things that come and go and change and move, and thoughts, no matter how good they are, they're still impermanent. And the world that we experience through the senses is, you know, it has its beauty, and that, but it's also forever changing. More and more you turn, you're less fascinated or enslaved by that, and you turn more toward this deathless reality, which doesn't cancel out thought or emotion, but it gives perspective to it. Well, for example, in Pali, the Hiriotapa is like shame, moral shame and dread. So that's like a good conscience or a sense of shame. And when you do something bad or dishonest, then we feel guilty, or we feel ashamed of ourselves, or our conscience. We know that we've done something wrong. And that is a very good thing, Hiriotapa. Without that, we'd all be psychopaths. You wouldn't have any sense of shame or anything. It'd be horrible. But then the guilt that people talk about now isn't shame. It's an obsession based on. I can see, like, because it, it's it isn't based on doing on committing a wrong act and then feeling ashamed of yourself, but it's a kind of endless proliferating tendency to interpret things in the way that you're somehow guilty about the world being the way it is, or about things going wrong, or you kind of assume that you become obsessed with yourself as being somebody who's wrong or does things wrong. Also, in the European sense, we're very idealistic. So I mean, like our society tends to see things in terms of ideals, how things should be, and so you hold up ideals of what, you know, how you should be, and then the realities of your life, you feel guilty that you can't be this pure, this brave, this noble, this superb person that you idealize. So you tend to feel, look down on yourself, or feel guilty of the fact that you can't sustain yourself as a kind of super, as this kind of superlative being that you should be. Wherein I noticed, like living in Thailand, Thai people were much more accepting of human frailty. And their human side wasn't idealizing so much. They were much more kind of grounded and recognized their humanity was like this. Where so many of us, again, living in a Thai monastery, we were always trying to make ourselves perfect. And there's a desperate attempt to live up to ideals. And they never feel quite good enough. So like say with the Vinaya, when you're training with this discipline, then one monk, I remember a Western monk came to me and he said, I can't be a monk. And I said, why? He says, because I'm not worthy of the robe. I said, why are you not worthy of the robe? He says, well, because I have such bad thoughts. And I said, well, we all have bad thoughts. And he said, you do. And I said, the robe doesn't mind. Because his idea was that some idealization of a monk, of a bhikkhu, none of us would be able to survive if that was the case. Then it wouldn't be human anymore. But the whole point of the monastic life was to reflect rather than to intimidate. So if you're just using ideals of what you should be as a way of intimidating somebody, then you'd just feel guilty all the time. But if you're using the convention of monasticism as a mirror for reflection, then it works very well. You begin to see how things come and go and the causes of suffering. But I've seen Western monks feel guilty about being hungry. They think hunger for food is kind of personal greed. They don't know that they don't differentiate. Like the body feels hungry because it needs nourishment. It needs food to survive. So it gets hungry, and then we could interpret, we translate that as I'm greedy for food, rather than seeing there's hunger. The body's hungry, and so some monks used to go on fast. Fast for long periods of time to fight against this greed, not using any wisdom, seeing that the body is a condition in nature that needs to be nourished, and when it doesn't get proper nourishment, it has these kind of reactions. It starts feeling, you feel hungry, and how you interpret that, you can say I'm hungry, I'm greedy, a hungry person, or the body is needs nourishment. thing, and also like the sexual desires and that of the body, the instinctual desires. These are oftentimes interpreted in a very highly personal way, rather than seen as just natural kind of energies and instinctual energies of a human body like this. So then you can reflect on it and see it, not feel guilty or feel that you know, that there's something wrong, you know, that you're not pure if these kind of energies arise in your consciousness. Because the whole aim is to develop this awareness and wisdom rather than to try to make yourself into some superman, something that none of us could be if, you know, that we're not this, the human realm is like this. And we've, it's like communism, you can think of, you know, how in this century, this idealization of a political system and a society, egalitarian society, and what happens, you know, an idea like communism becomes a form of tyranny rather than a kind of pure kind of egalitarian society where everybody is, where everything's fair and everything's equally distributed and everybody has equal rights. You know, you think, you know, it's a beautiful ideal in itself, but then it is an ideal, and it's not aware, you know, and in that idealization of how, you know, human society, the perfect society should be, you're not aware of the way we are or the way that people really are. You're just, so you end up, you know, when you do gain some kind of political power, of kind of tyrannizing everybody, trying to control them and force these kind of ideals down their throats. And in the process, you know, that's tyranny. You know, you can take the most high-minded ideas and force them on somebody, and they've been tyrannized by that. You know, so it's because the action itself, the karma, is forcing your will on somebody else, even though what you will toward them might be very high-minded. It's that act of oppression that they're feeling. So in when you see that like the in with wisdom, then you begin to see that you can't force things onto people without them being oppressed by it. No matter, like morality, for example, to force people to be moral can be oppressive. You know, they just feel oppressed by it, because they're being squashed by these ideas of morality. Like you in Kabul now, you know, you read about the in Afghanistan, this new government, this fundamental Islamic government taken over, and all the women now are forced into these long garments, the veils and so forth, and women can't go to school anymore, and they have to stay at home, and all the people, they destroy, kill off the old president and his brother, and there's pictures of them in the newspaper hanging from a gantry, and there's this kind of, you know, highly kind of moralistic system is being imposed on the Afghanis, and what is it? It's an oppression. It's a tyranny of the human spirit. Well, morality is, you know, you encourage it. You don't force it. You try to encourage people to rise up, and you give them opportunities and try to, you know, live in a way that you know they feel, you know, when they see you doing it, that they feel inspired by that. Me to kind of say you should be moral without me doing it is hypocrisy. But morality as an encouragement and then we kind of feel an interest, and then we rise up, and in that then it's a liberation of the human heart. Morality then is like a liberating experience rather than a feeling of just being forced and oppressed by a righteous system. And it's very interesting how, you know, the the political systems have been oppressive because of that. You know, trying to force socialism or morality or that onto masses of people, and then it ends up as a surprisingly some of the highest most idealistic political systems like communism ends up as a really corrupt and oppressive system because they don't understand the law of karma, how things actually work. That if you want a good result, you have to use a good means. You can't have a good result with wrong means. So once you start killing people, killing off the bad, there's an article somebody gave me yesterday, because in Cambodia now there's this problem with this Ieng Sary, who is a Khmer Rouge, one of the leaders, you know, along with Pol Pot, who's responsible for atrocities, and he's now defected from the Khmer Rouge, and they've given amnesty to him, which means he's, and then there's this moral question, you know, this man that has committed so many atrocities and has been responsible for so much human suffering is now somehow coming back into the fold and being accepted. And there's this strong reaction, you know, of resentment. And what is more important, peace or justice? You know, this is a question now. Should we try to, you know, spend our lives trying to punish these people who've done bad things, or what? Should we just, you know, not make that our important mission in life, but forgive? And this is, you know, some people get very upset by this possibility, because there's that in us that wants to persecute those who have persecuted us. And we want justice. We want to see them punished, get their just deserves. And they've done so many bad things. They should have to pay for it. And I can fully understand that feeling, you know, on an emotional level. But I also see, in terms of experience, that when I get caught in that desire for justice, wanting people to have to pay off, you know, get, you know, for what the things they've done wrong, to be punished for it, that is a mental state that is not peaceful. You know, it's not, when you really look at it, it's not peaceful mental state. And it can get very self-righteous, you know, like wanting to even kill the person who's killed my family or whatever. So then you think in terms of what we need to do now, in Rwanda or in Sri Lanka or in Cambodia or just wherever there, you know, there's these problems, or with the IRA or with the Israelis and the Palestinians, all this. There's no hope. It just goes on into endless conflicts, you know, because there's no end to that, just trying to seek revenge or seek justice. So then the Christian one, where Jesus says, as he's on the cross, says, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." And that's a very powerful statement, because, you know, when that helps you to have compassion, because you see people do these horrible things because they don't know what they're doing. If they saw clearly, they wouldn't do them. And then when you think of it in that way, then you feel more compassionate. You know, you begin to see that people, all these people that have killed, murdered, raped, pillaged, tortured people, are people that are suffering, you know, that they're caught in this horrible ignorance, that, and so they do these dreadful things. That helps you to see, to arouse compassion in your mind, and forgiveness. Then one can forgive them, And I noticed that, like with the Buddha's emphasis on suffering as the First Noble Truth, this is a brilliant common ground, you know, this is the common ground for all of us. We all suffer. And when we contemplate human suffering in general, just the problem of being a human being, then we feel compassion for each other, whether it's in Africa or Asia, or Europe or America, whatever, because we're looking at the common factor of our humanity. Where when you get into conflict and wars, where you ethnic biases and all that, then you racial prejudices and this kind of thing ends up in, you know, you did this to 200 years ago, you did this to my people, or I mean, it can be as silly as that, or, you know, or it can be quite immediate, like you killed my mother and daughter and sister, and I'm going to see that you pay for it. You know, that kind of revenge. Or what is a much more beautiful alternative is this forgiveness. But to have that forgiveness, you need to understand the common ground of suffering that we all share, and the result of being ignorant and selfish. You know, we all get caught in doing foolish or unkind or stupid things because of that. But there's a way out of that, and this hopefully the next century, there will be more of this kind of realization, because it's possible as human beings to, you know, this compassion. If we're going to live on this planet in any decent way, we need to develop this compassion, understanding the suffering that we all share, and being just the aging separation from the love. Like today, gratitude for parents. How many of you, you know, we all have to watch our parents get old and die. And that's part of human experience, isn't it? That's just the way it is. And that happens everywhere, you know, in every country, every race, every ethnic group. We all love our parents, and we remember them when they were vital and vigorous and all that, and then we see them get old and frail and senile and sickly and in pain, and then they die, and that kind of suffering we can all understand, you know, because we all human beings experience that, and we all experience having to be with what we don't like. We have so much of our life we have to put up with things that we don't like and that are unfair or just irritating or frustrating. And so, you know, that's a common human experience. And we all want things that we don't have yet. And that's another common human experience. And when we suffer from jealousy, and we suffer from vanity, and we suffer from the unfairness of life. And so sometimes life is just downright unfair to people, and we all have that feeling that sometimes that life is just being unfair to us, and that's everywhere. So I mean, when we contemplate in this way, then we develop karuna, metta karuna, toward each other and towards the animal realm too. You know, when you say you contemplate the animal world, it wants to live. Doesn't want to be, you know, its life, an animal's life is just as important to it as ours is to us, and we begin to say extend this sense of metta and compassion to sentient beings. And then the racial, cultural, ethnic differences are not very important anymore, or the bad things that people have done in the past are, you know, we can forgive. We can because we recognize that people do these dreadful things out of ignorance, not out of understanding. So then you think, well, I can, you know, I must put some effort in my life to get out of this ignorance. I mean, if I remain ignorant, how can I expect you to be wise and compassionate? You know, so we begin to look at ourselves as this is what we can do in this life. We can direct our attention and our interest in developing right thinking and wisdom and understanding. Then the political, social, economic, class, race, ethnic differences, I mean, they're all right. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But but the attachment to those identities always blinds us and forces us to do stupid things, harmful things to each other. Well, like the advice of the Buddha is to understand it. So first we have to, you know, we have to recognize it. And that means we need to look at it rather than just resist or resent it. We begin, like one's own suffering, like physical pain or emotional anguish or whatever we're experiencing. As we go to it and really feel it, then we begin to understand it as something that, in terms of as something that arises and ceases. So you're, because usually suffering brings up this resistance. So the ordinary person, when they start suffering, they resist it or distract themselves to something else. Where, say in meditator, then instead of resisting or distracting or blaming suffering on some outside cause, we start looking, accepting what this suffering, then we see the end of it. Because once we start accepting our suffering, the suffering ceases. It's not a permanent thing. And we begin to recognize the natural unsatisfactoriness of a human body and sensory experience, that is just, you know, the way it is in terms of this impermanent changing realm that we're experiencing. But we're not creating suffering around it anymore. So we still get old and we still have illnesses, diseases and death and loss of loved ones and having to be with the unloved. Well, this is still part of human experience, but we, instead of suffering from it, we understand it, and in that understanding, then we begin to experience a compassion for all beings, because we understand what suffering is and how we create this suffering around we're the creators of our own suffering. And it's interesting to see how, you know, even if somebody's persecuting you, that's his suffering. Your hatred of him is your suffering. But if you begin to contemplate if somebody is persecuting you, you can justifiably say, my suffering is due to him. If he stopped doing that, I wouldn't suffer. But which in a way is true, but sometimes we can't stop that, but we can stop creating suffering around what people are doing or saying about us, and to know that you have that, to know that you can do that is a very, you know, is a relief to the mind, to the heart, because most people don't know they can do that. They feel they're kind of stuck or hopeless, you know, victimized, or really, you know, that life is just being, they're just victims of experiences. But we do have this ability to liberate ourselves from suffering in the present. It's a good question. How does a compassionate society deal with crime? And crime is an ongoing challenge, and you notice like in the tendency now is to just build more prisons and try to lock them up. In California, I heard they're building 4 new prisons that will house 10,000 prisoners each. So they're expecting at least 40,000 more criminals. And it seems like, if your society's producing so many criminals, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with a society that it produces that much crime? That's a good question, just to ask yourself, what are we doing that too many people use crime as become criminals and have to be incarcerated? And you can realize that we're not really, we still operate very much with the idea of punishing people or just locking them up, getting them out of the way. And this is trying to just get rid of what annoys us. And this is very much our cultural habit of anything that gets in the way, get rid of it. In diseases or we want to get rid of all our kind of deformed people, put them in institutions there's a lot of things we don't want to look at, we don't want to see in our society and in ourselves. We just want to kind of conveniently dismiss or turn away from the unpleasantness. But wisdom is always the ability to embrace things, both the good and the bad, and the dark side of our society. And I think the more we try to understand suffering and try to say awaken ourselves to truth, then the conditions for criminality will diminish. But it's a long term thing. It's not gonna just the labor government gets in and Tony Blair can stop all crime in Great Britain. I don't foresee that. It's not like you can make such a promise. All you can do is kind of try to clean it up a little bit. But the real work has to come from each one of us, really. And that is where, like, being a responsible citizen and taking responsibility for your life. Because once you do that, then you're no longer prone towards criminality. But if you feel like a helpless victim in a cold-hearted society and you've just got to survive, then easily one could turn to crime as a expedient way to get what you want. But our society, we have to admit, they're based on ignorance, not understanding the human problem. And that's everywhere, not just here, everywhere it's that way. It's the materialist values. Like you can see just where you're constantly putting into people's minds these suggestions that they would be happy if they had all these wonderful things. And, where you're constantly titillating people. And with, you can see, like, now you get all these kind of horrible crimes done by children and really monstrous things where 12, 12, 13-year-old boys rape some woman, like they did the other day, and threw her in the river. And you know, really horrendous crimes that must, you know, you can't help but feel are being encouraged through videos and movies and whatnot. Because you start suggesting to people that these things are, you know, these are exciting things to do. And that they are, you know, violent. Any form of violence is exciting to the human mind. So, you know, that is, you know, that's just the way it is. That violence is an exciting vibration. So if you're trying to titillate people with watching violent things in television, you know, they're more likely going to try to do it. And get excitement, get the real excitement going. And because the society is based on ideals rather than on understanding of what's, you know, of trying to guide and encourage and educate people toward what is, you know, what is true and real and what is wholesome. And oftentimes what is wholesome and good is even, you know, made fun of for the sake of these more glamorous, placing the glamour in the kind of glitz with the criminal world. Yes? Yes. This is very, to me, this is the, you know, this is a very important, for a spiritually oriented person. With Buddhist meditators, oftentimes you get people who are merely interested in the psychology of things, you know, wanting to find happiness and get out of suffering in this life, in this world. But for me, I'm very much, kind of very much love the spiritual qualities of Buddha Dhamma, which I've definitely meditated on. And the there's a magnificent quotation in the scriptures. I mean, it sounds a bit dull in terms of the way it's stated, but in terms of its impact, or its meaning, is very profound. And many of you have heard me quote this about, there is the unborn, uncreated, unformed, therefore there is the, and there is an escape from the created, the born, and the formed. If there was not the unborn, uncreated, unformed, then there would be no escape from the created, the born, and the formed. But because there is the uncreated, unborn, unformed, then there is this escape. So, I mean, this is stating, you know, like what we're dealing with in terms of worldly things is all about the formed and the created, the born, like the body, or sensory experience is all changing, conditioned, and we're very much identified and bound and mesmerized by the created, the born, and the formed, the conditioned. And yet, something in us, I mean, all spiritual, all religions point to the deathless as the ultimate reality, you know, and so in this statement, there is the conditioned and the unconditioned, and then in meditation, one is investigating, exploring that relationship, because the conditioned is quite obvious to us. You know, the body is an obvious one, or the what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, thought itself, emotional habits, all the rest. These are conditions, changing, impermanent conditions, and that we're all used to and oftentimes attached to. But as we investigate it, then we're using mindfulness and awareness in which we begin to observe that that's not all there is, that when things cease, you know, and then we contemplate the cessation, like the third noble truth is the realization of cessation of a condition. So more and more we apply that to the ceasing conditions that we're experiencing, and through that we realize the deathless or nibbana, or some words the Buddha used to point to that realization. So it's compared, you can use the example of space and form. For example, here in the room, as you contemplate, you know, most of us are very much influenced by the forms in this room. So we look at each other and the shrine and the pictures and that. But then if you suddenly detach from the forms, you're looking at the space. You can actually see space. And then you contemplate space. More and more you're looking at space. It doesn't have any quality other than being spacious. But as you begin to notice and pay attention to space, then the forms in the space are related to, you know, they come and go, but the space always here, you know, and the building is in the space. I mean, we think of it, maybe the space is in the room, but then as we contemplate, we realize the room is in the space, the building is in the space, and we realize space is infinite in terms of, you know, just it goes on and on. It has no boundaries. It's infinite. Space is infinite. So then we're beginning to realize infinity as experience, and then we use that in terms of silence and sound. I teach a lot about using the inner silence, sound of silence, as beginning to recognize the silence of the mind where before the thoughts arise, or that, you know, so you're beginning to recognize the relationship between sound and silence, and then silence is infinite. It's not, you know, it embraces everything. It has no shape, no form. It's infinite. So then the conditions of sound come and go, thought and sound come and go in the silence of the mind. So more and more as you investigate that, then you're realizing the silence, the space, the deathless, unconditioned, you know, and you're letting go of your attachment to the conditioned forms and your identity with your body or your views and opinions or your emotions. You're not getting rid of them, but you're no longer identifying or need to attach, because you see them for what they are and you're no longer deluded by them. The deathless, the unconditioned, you notice it's all negation. Unborn, uncreated, because these are, can you imagine anything deathless? Imagination stops, doesn't it? Because imagery is about forms. You can create a concept about deathless, but it's usually a negating a condition. So like the death is a condition, and then deathless is a negation of a condition, or unborn. Born is a condition, then you negate it, and that. So notice that negation of things isn't denial, but it's pointing to a realization that is here and now, but which we don't notice. We've forgotten about. We keep, because we're so conditioned to to attach to the conditioning, to the conditions around us. Like just going from one thing to another. You know, you find yourself sometimes just racing around, going from this to that. And I remember when I was a university student, you know, I used to get burnt out all the time because I was just running around from this to that. And I could hardly finish anything because I was so caught up in this kind of restless movement of going from this to that. And it was real suffering. At first, for a while, at the beginning, it was quite exciting, you know, to go from this to that. But after a while, so much of that is just so exhausting and so wearisome. Yeah, that also, like mantra can be very, very helpful, especially to a very restless mind where you just use a mantra to stop the proliferating mind. And so like it works very well with tranquility, with getting tranquil, calming down. Stopping the thinking process from just the habitual kind of conceptual proliferating habits of going from one thought to another. Also, thinking of yourself in positive ways is, you know, also takes some reflection. Like if you're contemplating as a mantra, you can use it for tranquility. But then, if you really want to get a feeling, you know, the kind of heart opening experience, then you need to contemplate it more. So your mind is looking at something and open to it rather than merely tranquilizing the thought process. Otherwise, at least this is from my experience, if once you can suppress things through repetition and you can get high on it, you know, you can get very, by the power of positive thinking, you can get very high. But then it also can suddenly drop because it's based on repression rather than on understanding. But as you, I've seen like I've met born again Christians, people like that who are very much, who oftentimes come on in a very kind of radiant way, and they're full of this kind of light and this kind of radiant quality when they're talking about Jesus and how, you know, their life as a Christian. But then they can can suddenly stop too, and if you don't agree with them they can get quite nasty. So, I mean, so you can be quite impressed, you know, by the kind of radiance and the kind of quality that they present themselves through their faith and positiveness. But then in terms of wisdom, it doesn't run deep because their minds are trained only to hear the words that reinforce their particular thing they're attached to. And so there's, like, I remember meeting one years ago here in England, a born-again Christian, really, you know, impressive-looking man, and he just really kind of, when he started talking to me, his eyes shone, light coming out, and he kind of beautiful presence, and I stood there quite mesmerized by him, but then he couldn't appreciate what I was doing. As soon as I tried to talk about my life as a monk, he would immediately try to knock it down and saying, you know, it's not what Jesus taught and that. And he couldn't get his mind around the goodness of my life and appreciate my life. And so I could see that it was a very conditioned form of radiant, being positive, but it didn't have wisdom in it. It couldn't recognize goodness except in when it looked like Jesus Christ or looked like his version of Jesus Christ. Whereas as you contemplate more, then goodness is something you begin to recognize, not in terms of just being looking like Buddhism, but you relate to goodness on the heart level rather than on the kind of symbolic or conventional level. You're more intuitive. You're more picking up goodness in people, and universally, you know, rather than conventionally, as you develop more from the heart than from the attachment to a particular conventional style. That's where religion oftentimes blinds people, because they get so attached to the convention they can't recognize anything outside their convention. Blinds them to that which is beyond it, or that which doesn't look like it. They can't recognize it. Where if you're really tuning into goodness on a universal level, you know, then in beauty and truth and that getting beyond just the conventional definitions of it, religious definitions, then you can relate to that in the universe around you. You know, it permeates. It's not dependent on being a Buddhist or Christian, or agreeing with my particular conventional attachments. I found like I used to find mantra very helpful at first, because of the, I felt like, generally, in Theravada Buddhism, they start you with the Anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. And when I first started meditating, I couldn't concentrate on my breath at all. Just mind just wander away. You know, there's just no awareness on the body at all, as such a cerebral character. That I used mantra for a while, and that was very helpful to calm the mind, tranquilize the mind. And I still like to meditate on just the word peace, you know, and just kind of like breathing in, breathing out, peace. And you go into this kind of blissful state, just thinking, you know, as you're inhaling peace, exhaling peace, you know, you get into a kind of blissful state. Because that word, you know, has that kind of effect on my mind. Now, like word Buddha, we have the in Thailand they use the mantra Bhutto, which is the mantric form of Buddha, and so I can do that now. I've developed that kind of Bhutto mantra, so that I found leads to a kind of, it leads into jhana, or into these kind of blissful states, concentrated states. Then in vipassana meditation, you're more it's a contemplative style, where it's investigative, and That's where you're developing the wisdom, using the wisdom. So I think I will not be here next Sunday. I'll ask Dajahn Viradhamo, because I will be in San Francisco. I'm going to this conference, very interesting conference, and all kind of very important people will be there. I'm going half out of curiosity. It has the most kind of incredible collection of VIPs, including Mikhail Gorbachev is the kind of chairman of it, and then they have the ex-president of Costa Rica and the president of Haiti I think Desmond Tutu is on the committee, and I don't think he'll be there, but I mean it's got a whole list of kind of famous people, but all these people are different, from science, from politics, from academia, from religion, psychology, and so forth. Writers and artists and all that is quite all embracing. They're meeting it's called State of the World Forum, and I think they're concerned about the approaching to year 2000 AD and interest in trying to form some kind of international network of people to try to maybe discuss or deal with the problems and difficulties of a modern global village life that we're all facing. So it seems like quite a good thing, and one wants to support it. And then I'm on a special panel called The Revival of Buddhism in the 20th Century. So what that... have you given me 5 minutes to say something? I don't think you probably don't think it's possible for me to say anything meaningful in 5 minutes. It takes me a long time, doesn't it?